Romeo, India Whiskey. And my name is Dick. You'll also hear Kilo 2, Kilo Echo Yankee. His name is Mel. Mel and Dick attempt to organize this enthusiastic crowd that gathers most Sunday evenings, and an educational process takes place. These people are attempting to teach each other how radio works, how wireless works, how physics works. So you're hearing the sound of education as primarily what goes on. A little bit of entertainment sneaks in. These guys represent the smart guys, we think, of the New York City, United States area. In other words, near northeastern New Jersey, southern New York State, western Long Island, and southwestern Connecticut. That's what this particular repeater has as a coverage area, and the people in that area will gather. The subjects of discussion are usually the subjects that are brought up by the people who check in with a question. So there's no real planned subject most of the time. If you don't like the subject, then maybe you don't like the particular questions that these people just happen to ask. Some of the questions are a little bit complicated. Some of them are very simple. The ranges are across the whole spectrum of computers, radio, wireless, antennas, and so on. By way of these technical nets, people do find out an awful lot more about how transmission lines and antennas and propagation takes place, how radio really works. The schools seem to do a only mediocre job of teaching that. And you really want a person who understands radio. Quite often you want to hire a ham radio operator. There are colleges in New Jersey where the professors will recommend that the students listen to things like the technical net in order to get hands-on experience, so to speak, as to
repeater, timeout, cancel.
To get hands-on experience as to how radio really works. There was an example of what you're supposed to do. Give an interruption every minute or minute and a half to make sure the machine gets a chance to reset. And some of us all forget that from time to time. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. If you're just listening, you need not sign in, because after 27 and a half years by now, we accept the fact that there are people out there listening. So it's mostly the questioners or people with a comment that do check in and give Mel and Dick call letters and name and the word yes, which confirms that that is their intent. Last week, Les K2TGW signed in, and we didn't get a chance to talk to Les. So that makes him automatically number one this week when he does check in. Wesley, of course, we know that he will be checking in into XJN. He's already on the list. And that laboratory on 60th Street is getting bigger and more influential. You'll be hearing more about that as time goes on. So, for those who want to check in and give me your call letters and name at this time, please do. K2RIW listening.
K2KND, Richie, with a comment.
Hey, K2KEY, Dick, I want to say something before we begin.
Okay, so far we've got Rich and Mel. Anyone else?
KC2, Whiskey Cop Bravo. John, yes.
Okay, we've got John. Right now it's Rich, Mel, and John in that order. For the introductory material before we get into the real questions. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
WS2N, Paul, with a space station update.
Glad to hear that, Paul. And we got very few space shuttle missions left. In fact, there's a very nice PBS special about, I can't think of the lady's name right now, a female astronaut who was the standby for Krista McAuliffe.
Morgan.
Okay, what's Mrs. Morgan's first name?
I forget it. Mrs. Morgan.
Okay, Mrs. Morgan from Idaho, as I remember. Very interesting person. And, Rich. We're going to turn it over to Rich K2KNB, and I suspect you've had a rather successful campaign, Rich, of you ran a particular crusade, and it turned out very successful, and I'm grateful to you. What I think Rich is going to tell us about is that a application was made by, at least the first person I know about who started it was Alan, KC2RFN. Made application for a particular award, and I think Rich was heavily involved in that. K2KNB, K2RIW in the deck net.
All right, thank you, Dick, and this is K2KNB. Well, I got involved, from the point of view of being notified and would I then proceed from that point. But for those of you who don't know, Dick had been nominated for and will be receiving the ARRL Technical Achievement Award, which is a very prestigious award. It's a national award. And of course, everyone from Limox is very, very proud of that. And everyone who listens to the TechNet should be very proud of that, because for all of these years that Dick has taken his time to share his knowledge and mentor and make amateur radio a very worthwhile experience and improve our technical skills, our intellectual skills, our debating skills, and a whole bunch of other things. Very much appreciated. The award is very much deserved. You know, it is an irony or a funny thing, I'm not sure which, but on those few nights when Dick has shown up late, I believe people had to go to their calendars to make sure that it was, in fact, Sunday night. Anyway, Dick, congratulations. It's an award certainly well-deserved. Back to net. This is K2KNB.
Thank you, Rich. Rich, that is the first minor mistake I've ever heard you make. You called it the Technical Achievement Award, which I wish it also was. It is the Technical Service Award. Very, very close to the same, but both a national award and a similar technical award was given to me by Limark itself, and the award, which is hanging on my shelf, hanging on my wall, doesn't have a date on it. I wasn't smart enough to put a date on it. So I'm going to give you a homework assignment, Rich. When Limark gave me an award for the Technical Net a good number of years ago, do you happen to know what year that was, so I can write it on the award to complete its records, if you know what I mean? Mel, K2KEY, as you know, from my point of view, it really is the Technical Net and the group of people that are getting this award. K2KEY, K2RIW, you got it, Mel.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. I want to give congratulations to you, and I want to also thank all those that I spoke to, either on the telephone or communicated via email, to push for the ARRL to issue the at least some appreciation for all the work that you've done, really putting your heart into this, Dick. And I know I appreciate it, and I'm happy to be part of it. So let's continue with the TechNet, Dick. Again, congratulations. Let's, I guess, keep it going.
Yeah, this Technical Net has only existed since September of 1982, 27 years. It's a fairly young net, and we intend to keep doing that, if all goes well, if we all stay healthy. And I suspect we've started enough of a tradition that even if we become unavailable, I'd like to believe that Limark and others who gather here would continue it. Something else I was going to mention, can't think of it right now. Let's see if Les is available. K2TGW, are you there, Les? K2RIW in the TechNet? Apparently not. And so now we're going to get a nice, serious technical question from Wesley. What's the laboratory on 60th Street doing this week, Wesley? N2XJM, K2RIW.
Or am I checking in? Okay. Greetings, everyone. This is November, 2X3, Julius, November. Dicky, how is my audio?
Your audio is beautiful. John, you're recognized, and you're on the list. Good audio, so go right ahead, Wesley.
Okay, 250. So, no interpart. We're multipath, I'm sorry. Okay. For the week I was learning that all of the equipment that I have acquired, and I get much better in it. And I have a few questions to you. When you have a toroidal cylinder and you wind the first winding on it, and let's say 100 winds on it, and then you have a secondary on it, and you can move that secondary, thanks to Eric, who actually told me that I'm supposed to do it scientific quantic way, not the sloppy way. Thank you, Eric. And then you deliver from the generator at first sine wave, at second square wave. What a big difference. What a big difference. And the poor man's scope on the secondary is the small light bulb, 2, 3 volts, 5 volts, whatever. And, of course, that light bulb has a different impedance. It's not 50 ohms and not 600 ohms. Let me drop. Okay, so what I find out is that in my particular case, when I deliver the sine wave, I was getting the very wide resonance response, starts from 10 kilohertz and ending at about 100 kilohertz. But when I deliver the square wave, I had a number of peaks on it. And they were very narrow and very persistent and very high. I'm trying to find out what is the difference. That's the first question. The second question that I have, if let's say you have this primary that has 100 winds on it, and then from on the top of it you have two secondaries, one is clockwise and the other one is counterclockwise. Each one has 5 winds on it. And you connect these two secondaries in series. In my mind, the field is supposed to cancel. Guess what? It's not canceling. I'm trying to understand that. That's the set of the questions. I have another one, but that would be later. Dick, back to you.
Fascinating. Toroid, let's hope that the toroid you're using is either tape wound or ferrite and is rated for frequencies like 10 kilohertz, 100 kilohertz that you're experimenting with.
2,000 permeability.
Okay, permeability of 2,000. And depending on what voltage you're putting on, those 100 turns of the primary, hopefully saturation is not taking place. One of the things that's not well understood by everybody, so I'm going to say it even though you know it, and that is knowing the permeability of the toroid material. That's really a way of saying how much better does the magnetic field flow through the toroid material than it flows through air. And a permeability of 2,000 means that the magnetic field likes to flow through the ferrite material 2,000 times easier than it does flow through air. Or another way of looking at it is if you had an air-wound coil, and if by some magic you could wind the same number of turns around this toroid material, you might have an inductance that's almost 2,000 times higher. So that's a pretty good material. As you go lower and lower in frequency, depending on the number of turns, the cross-sectional area, and the other characteristics of the material, you might start running into some saturation effects. I don't think you're doing that. When you put in the sine wave and you get a fairly broadband response, let me drop, from 10 kilohertz to 100 kilohertz, primary, if I understand correctly, is 100 turns, secondary is something like 5 turns, and you first put it into a light bulb. A light bulb is an extremely interesting load. A completely cold filament on a light bulb, if you measured it with your ohm meter, it measures a certain number of ohms. If you then put the full voltage on the light bulb, and you measure the current that it draws at that full voltage, and you use Ohm's law, and you calculate backwards what is the resistance of the light bulb, you'll find that a fully lit light bulb has a resistance that's more than 10 times higher than when the light bulb is cold. So an ohm meter directly across the light bulb will show you 1/10 the number of ohms. That's because the tungsten material, as it heats up in order to get hot enough to give off light, has a much, much higher resistance to it. And as you put various frequencies into the light bulb, you're now, in some cases, running into the thermal frequency response of the light bulb. I don't think you are in your case. In other words, during your actual sine wave, which has got a peak in voltage, and it goes through zero, and then the opposite peak in voltage, I suspect throughout that cycle of, let's say, 100 kc, which is 10 microseconds for complete cycle, I'm reasonably sure that very little temperature variation occurs across that cycle. In other words, there's a nearly constant temperature for that 10 microseconds. As you get down to very low frequencies, like 10 hertz, the light bulb will be flickering, and therefore it has a higher resistance at the peak voltage and a lower resistance at the lower voltage, and you get some other peculiar effects. You're not getting that, but it's just something to put in the back of your mind as something that a light bulb can do. Let me drop. Now, a pure sine wave, in theory, has nothing there but one frequency. A square wave, if you take your square wave signal generator with the right kind of a attenuator, or the, make the signal small enough so that it doesn't overload your spectrum analyzer, at first you will think it looks like a signal with a whole lot of noise around it. When you expand the spectrum analyzer correctly, you'll find out that a thoroughly symmetric sine wave has a whole large number of odd harmonics. If, for instance, you set the sine wave, the square wave, at 10 kilohertz, you would see 10 kilohertz components, 30 kilohertz, 50 kilohertz, 70 kilohertz, 90 kilohertz, and so on. All of the odd components. The even components, which are very, very weak, will slowly start coming up if you made the square wave a little bit non-symmetric. In other words, if the positive half was 51% and the negative half was 49% of the time. And also, the square wave, many square wave generators will also have a DC offset knob. Let me drop. Where if it was a thoroughly symmetric square wave, you might set it for plus and minus 1 volt. So it would be plus 1 volt during the 50% in the beginning, and then the second 50% will be minus 1 volt. Well, if you made it plus 1.5 volts and minus a half volt square wave, it still has the right timing characteristic, but now it also has a DC value added to that. So there's a kind of a superposition going on. And you got to be careful about whether or not the DC value is thoroughly symmetric, because the slightest amount of DC offset, if, for instance, you decided to set it for plus and minus 1 volt, and because of some kind of an error in setting the knobs, it became plus 1.1 volt and minus 0.9 volt. On an oscilloscope, until you look very careful, it would look like a perfect square wave. In reality, the tenth of a volt offset that I just gave in my example, 1.1 volt positive, minus 0.9, that would, in a very short period of time, create a DC current flowing through the primary winding, which will saturate the core partially of the toroid, and that will change its characteristics tremendously. You would have a lot of fun doing experiments of looking at the way your transformer behaves with various amounts of DC offset, and that's also a function of what is the impedance of the signal generator and so on, and how much cross-sectional area you've got. So there's a lot of knobs you've got to play with there that are not obvious at first. Let me drop. But now getting back to the core of your question, because there is a large number of odd harmonics of the square wave, and let's hope that there is no DC offset to your square wave, which you could guarantee if you made a great big capacitor between your signal generator and the primary winding, that would take care of the DC offset, a large capacitor, some significant number of microfarads, which now would make sure that there's no DC current flowing in the primary, creating any saturation characteristics. So you got to worry about that, because some square wave generators find it much easier to create a DC offset that's not obvious, whereas the sine wave generators tend not to do that. Now that you've got a large number of odd harmonics, as you sweep the frequency of that square wave, those various odd harmonics can possibly find certain resonance characteristics of your primary winding, your secondary winding, maybe the light bulb, and so on. So what's really happening? Why you get certain peaks and valleys as you try to put in a constant amplitude square wave and sweep the frequency? As you can tell, I don't have a complete answer for that. Don't have a complete answer for anything, but you know what I mean. At least I've showed you some of the things to look for, whether or not there's a DC offset and any saturation characteristic taking place. So that was the first half of your question. Let's talk about that before we talk about the clockwise and counterclockwise. I wonder if some of that makes sense. I wonder if you've had a chance to look very carefully with your oscilloscope to make sure there was no DC offset from the signal generator.
Hey, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, Eric. And by the way, Erica, a little bit later, I'd love to have a discussion with you on three-dimensional television, because the August issue of IEEE Spectrum magazine has three articles on the subject, and boy, do I have questions for you when we get there. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. I just wanted to point out to you that what Wesley has wound is not a toroid, okay? He's actually wound it on the outside of the core, so it's not your traditional toroid in that sense. But it is a series of cores that are, lengthwise together, and his transformer is wound on the top side of it, not through the core, so the permeability is a little bit different.
Very interesting. Sounds like you've been to his laboratory and you've seen the experiment itself. Give me a little bit more of a description. If I had, for instance, a toroid that is, let's say, 2 inches in diameter, with a donut hole in the center that's 1 inch in diameter, and the thing is a half inch high. If that was the core I was using, and I want to use it in the manner in which Wesley is now using it, would I be winding the wire from 6 o'clock to 12 o'clock on the outside of the toroid? Is that approximately what took place? Over to you, Eric.
That's correct, Dick. The center hole is empty.
Okay, that's a very different way of looking at of using the toroid. Now, if this is a ferrite toroid, I think you would get a somewhat predictable performance out of that. If it was a tape-wound toroid, I'm now concerned about other crazy effects. Do you believe it's a ferrite-like toroid that Wesley's using? Over to you, Eric.
Well, think of it as a big, solid bar of ferrite with a hole in the center.
Okay. If you know what a Cinturato... core tire. There's an Italian company that makes a kind of tire where you don't have bias ply on the inside, but the cords go around the perimeter of the tire in the longest dimension. The reason why you would do that is if you were doing a certain kind of road rally competition, as the tire heats up, you don't want the outer dimension, the circumference of the tire to change, which will change the speedometer reading, and you're trying to do a very accurate running of the automobile for this competition. So is he winding it around the outer perimeter of the toroid, or is he winding it across the hole but on the outside? Over to you, Eric.
KC2JSN.
JSN recognized. Eric, are you still there?
Yeah, just, let me give you an answer in a second, Dick.
Roger, we'll stand by. Maybe you're changing something on the machine.
Wesley's winding that as you would see the tread on the tire itself.
All right, now let me give you an answer, okay?
Go for it.
He is winding the perimeter of the outside of the core. Whereas you can think of it as a coil form, or think of it, actually, you'd better think of it as a an air wound transformer with a ferrite core in it that happens to have a hole in the center. I think that would be a better way to describe it.
Okay. I'm going to add some extra words, and you're going to confirm. If I took the axis of his winding and the axis of the toroid, those two axes are collinear. Is that what you're saying, Eric?
That's correct.
Okay, very interesting. Now, with that method of winding, wow. See, the main advantage of a toroid, Wesley, and why the majority of people will wind wire through the hole, is that a toroid is extremely good at keeping all of the magnetic field created by the current of the winding, keeping it enclosed within the toroid. And although people work very hard about making sure that the primary winding and the secondary winding are directly on top of each other, in the case of a toroid, you almost don't have that restriction or requirement. You could, in theory, wrap a few turns through the hole near the 12 o'clock position on the toroid and call that your primary, and wind a few turns through the hole of the toroid near the 6 o'clock position. And although they're displaced, if you then slid the secondary winding from the 6 o'clock position over to the 5 o'clock, the 4 o'clock, and started moving it toward the 12 o'clock position, so it's almost on top of each other, there would be extremely little change in the characteristic. That's the magic of a toroid. That's why people love to wind it that way. It's very forgiving. Whereas when you make a solenoid-like coil, and I believe your coil is more solenoid-like, even though it doesn't have a lot of length to it, and then you're using the toroid in that particular manner where you've slipped the toroid major axis through the axis of your windings, you now run into the situation where minor deviations in positioning, in other words, if you've got a clockwise secondary winding and a counterclockwise secondary winding, if they have the slightest amount of movement in the Z-axis, in the axis of the windings themselves, they will have different amount of coupling, a different amount of leakage reactants between primary and secondary number one and secondary number two. I mean,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
I can say the word.
So with that method of winding, you're going to get minor differences, and therefore the clockwise winding and the counterclockwise winding put in series with each other might not give you total cancellation. They should give you partial cancellation, but it may not be total. So you're using the toroid in a very unusual way, which makes it an extremely interesting experiment. And Wesley is obviously thinking out of the box. Very few people have thought of using a toroid this way. And he may find some great new advantage in doing it. Back to you for some more words on this one, Wesley. You got an interesting experiment. The N2XJN, K2RIW, TechNet, wait for the beep.
Okay, N2XJN. Yes. Imagine the old antennas with the on the ferrite. That's how it looks like. The only difference is that my cylinder is made from the ferrite, glued together, and then tape on the top so it holds together. And the longest one was 20 inches long. Let me drop. Okay. And I have a primary on it, and I have a secondary on it. Now, quite few things that I completely do not understand. This is the low frequency toroid. And when I put it on network analyzer, the biggest peak was 75 megahertz. I was seeing the peaks on 28 kilohertz and 115 kilohertz pretty fine with the square waves. And I just put the sine wave to check it out. I had the one big response to it, so I'm not interested with it. And then I tune my network analyzer, and I find out, yes, I do have around 28 kilohertz and 115 kilohertz. I do have a peak. And I still do not understand how come I can have a 75 megahertz, which I don't have a generator to deliver that much, that high frequency square wave. And that I'm getting, and I put them there on the impedance phase gain analyzer, and I had the same. Let me jump around 75 megahertz of the response. Now, as far as the two coils concerned, well, Dick, it's a little bit more complicated. I don't want you to laugh at me, but yeah. There is a chance to have, instead of having that ringing, typical ringing signal that is starting from the peak and getting smaller, you can have it reverse. But that's another story. Back to you, Dick, and to Exim.
Let me just drop something in there.
Go right ahead, Eric.
I think Wesley is using, it looks like 14 or 16 gauge wire, so some of the response that he's getting is due to skin effect.
Okay. Could very well be. Very fine. I think you said 26 gauge wire. Not quite Litz wire, so to speak, but...
No, 14 or 16 is real thick stuff.
That's the primary. What's the secondary?
It looks to me almost the same thickness.
Okay. I have the impression that the sine and square wave generator, you swept those from 10 kilohertz to 100 kilohertz, and you found I think you said a 28 kilohertz resonance, and I forget what the other frequency is, something like 75?
115.
115, okay, 115.
And then over Southern on my network analyzer, so 75 megahertz, the maximum peak. But of course, it showed me that 28 and 115, it shows me as a smaller peak.
I'm going to make a guess that your sine wave generator and your square wave generator do not go as high as 75 megacycles. That's the reason why you saw that on the network analyzer. Almost every, and I'm getting the guess, the question, I'm getting the expression, I'm making a guess that you have stacked a number of toroids together, side by side, axes all collinear, as a method of making a very long piece of ferrite, a much more massive piece of ferrite, and you've held it together with tape, and then you've wrapped the turns around that cylinder of toroids. Am I correct in that one so far, Wesley? Go ahead.
Yeah, and the last one, I glued them together with a crazy glue, and I put the tape so it holds solid.
Okay. In the case of a Tesla coil, many people have a piece of PVC tubing, a couple of inches in diameter, maybe a couple of feet tall, and they wind very fine wire and thousands of turns along that as the secondary. I'm guessing you're making the 2010 improvement to a Tesla coil by doing it out of ferrite for that vertical tube in order to get higher inductance, and therefore you have more capability of changing turns ratios. You get better coupling in theory between the primary and the secondary. Interesting experiment. The thing I worry about a little bit, though, is that in order for a Tesla coil to really do its thing, to work very well, it has some of the characteristics of a Ford spark coil. In other words, usually the primary is fed with some form of high voltage generator into a spark gap. The spark gap creates an extremely brief high current pulse of voltage injected into the primary, and then the pulse goes away. The spark gap becomes an open circuit. The secondary winding gives you a huge step up in voltage, and its natural resonant frequency is where the secondary then rings at maybe the megacycle or 75 megacycle rate there, I'm not sure.
Dick, that means that if I have this kind of transformer, the secondary, if I have two winds, three winds, five winds, the resonance of the secondary is the resonance of the whole transformer?
I think that's 98% accurate, Wesley. In other words, because the secondary winding is the one that is most massive, it has the largest number of turns, it usually has a large metallic anode structure on the top of it, the bottom of it is usually grounded, but the secondary is the dominant winding. The resonance of that secondary winding, I think, really determines the resonance of a usual air-wound Tesla coil. When you make a ferrite-wound Tesla coil, I'm a little bit concerned about the fact that the ferrite itself has a finite frequency response. In other words, the ferrite material has a lot more inductance per number of turns. That could be good. It has a lot more capacitance per turn because of its natural way it's made. Let me drop. The ferrite material has a whole bunch of grains of material held together with some kind of an adhesive that holds the whole thing together. And depending on the size of those grains, the spacing of the grains, how well they touch each other, the ferrite itself has some natural resonant frequency characteristics that air would not have. Now, are the ferrite resonant frequencies and the damping effect, I'm a little worried about a damping effect with the ferrite material, which might impede, in some cases, the Tesla effect of a great big high voltage being generated. It might impede it, it might aid it. Until a whole lot of experiments are run, are you going to come out ahead or behind because of using the ferrite? If I know you, you're enough of a scientist that you're going to make two Tesla coils at least, one with air, one with ferrite, and you're going to compare the results between the two. But the fact that the ferrite itself, with its winding, shows certain resonance effects, some of that could be winding resonance, some of that could be ferrite resonance, some of that could be the combination a ferrite in winding. Is it fish or fowl, so to speak? It's going to take a number of experiments to find out what's happening. You're making a very unusual Tesla coil. Would I be correct in assuming that this is the Wesley version of 2010 for a Tesla coil? You might not have ever seen an article that recommended this method of construction. I think you're thinking quite far out of the normal box. Am I correct with that guess, Wesley? N2XJN, K2LIW on the TechNet.
That's my approach, and this approach is actually dedicated to the certain concepts and the certain achievement that I expect from that. And it works a little bit different. What is being done is the generator is actually powering the MOSFET. The MOSFET is delivering the voltage to the high voltage transformer. The one end of the secondary of the high voltage transformer is then going to the ground, and the ground is essential. And the another end of the secondary is delivered to the long winding of, let's say, 100 winds on that coil that is on the ferrite. Then the another end of the primer of the ferrite goes back to the ground. Then on the top of it, I have a secondary coil. Now, I have a secondary coil. One is clockwise and one is counterclockwise. Each one is 5 winds. They're supposed to be canceled. They are not canceling. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, let me ask a couple of interesting questions here. When you look at one of the secondary windings with 5 turns and you measure the voltage, and you look at the other, the clockwise one first, and you look at the counterclockwise one second, I am guessing the voltage on each is close to the same voltage, but when you put them together, clockwise and counterclockwise, in series with the proper wiring so that they are bucking as opposed to adding, my guess is you get a lower voltage but not quite complete canceling. Is that approximately right, Wesley? Back to you.
No, it's a higher voltage. It's a higher voltage. Eric would be able to explain to you what's going on. It's a higher voltage, much higher voltage. I have showed to Eric that capacitor, when you have a tooth, imagine you have yourself having a capacitor with the 2 big plates on it. Just imagine that. And you're trying to load that capacitor. And then you put one impulse, so you have a positive on one side, a negative on response on the other side. Let me jump. And if there is a certain air gap between them, so the induction goes straight from one plate to the other, but the magnetic field goes right way with the right-hand control. It doesn't have to be a physical capacitor. I'm just giving the example of physical capacitor. It could be a capacitance of the coil. Doesn't matter. Now, if you put the coil on the right-hand side of that capacitor, that magnetic field is trying to load, to energize that coil. If then this coil from the right-hand side is connected to that capacitor, is trying to load back that capacitor. And at this point, instead of the signal diminishing, you get the signal growing up indefinitely. And it's not going to be indefinite because in real situation, when you put the spark on it, the life of the spark is actually ending another impulse. Now what's going to happen then, let me drop, that if this capacitor has a certain memory, because it does have a certain memory, and you use the fast enough impulses, then the first impulse didn't get gone. It's some of the energy that is left over then the next impulse is coming, and it's actually loading up, and loading up, and loading up. And at the end of it, you see actually increasing the energy. Back to you, Dick, and to Xia.
I think I see what you're trying to do. After each impulse from your MOSFET circuit, you set the Tesla coil into a ringing phenomena, and if the timing is correct for the next impulse that comes along, it could be aiding to the, you know, that it doesn't get a chance to ring all the way down before the next impulse comes along, and you want the next one to be co-phase with the ringing pulse so that it adds. Now, when it comes to clockwise and counterclockwise, your clockwise winding has a starting wire and an ending wire. Your counterclockwise winding has a starting wire and an ending wire. Depending on the way you connect the two together, there are four possible combinations. You can decide to use wire number one or wire number two of the first winding, the clockwise winding. You can decide to use wire number two or wire number one of the second winding, the counterclockwise winding. So there's four different ways of putting them together. And without carefully studying the so-called right-hand rule, what you think would be aiding might be canceling and so on. You did say that the combination is giving you a higher voltage. Most likely you've got them in the aiding direction rather than in the canceling direction of the four possible combinations of wiring. That's what I think is one of the things going on. One other thing I want to mention to you. Let me drop. And that is the way many people feed a Tesla coil is to start off with a very high voltage AC. In some cases, it's a pulse pig transformer wired backwards so that something like 13 kilovolts is coming out of the winding. That goes into a spark gap mechanism that goes into the primary of the Tesla coil. And therefore, they are sparking it on the first half cycle in, let's call it, the positive direction. On the second half of the 60 cycles, they're sparking in the negative direction. So they're doing bi-directional sparking with the way the spark gap feeds the primary. In your particular case, you have a MOSFET circuit that's being fired by something like a square wave generator, and the MOSFET is always pumping current into the primary winding in the same direction, and there isn't a second MOSFET pumping current in the other direction. I'm not sure you need that, but it's just something to put in the back of your mind that is a little bit of a difference.
Dick, there is no AC current in my situation. I do not deal with the AC at all. Although, from the secondary winding, you do not have a nice square wave any longer. Back to you.
Oh, I certainly accept that. Your secondary has its own resonance effect, and after each impulse that comes from your MOSFET circuit, the secondary does some form of ring down. It would be interesting to find out what would happen if you used a total of four MOSFETs, not just one, in what's called an H-bridge, which means on the first half cycle, it pulsed the primary in the positive direction. On the second half cycle, it would pulse the primary in the opposite direction. Would that make a difference when it comes to ferrite saturation and the overall response in the buildup of energy? I'm not sure, but it's something to consider. Your circuit is always with DC voltage, pumping current into the primary, always in the same direction, which could be creating a little bit of a saturation effect of the ferrite. An air-wound toroid wouldn't be saturating. A ferrite one might. Let me see if Eric has worked with some ferrites and if he sees what I'm saying and if he thinks it's a concern. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. There's a couple of things that are going on here that isn't really quite getting explained. And what you really should do is ask Wesley what the source of the primary voltage is. And it's not just a MOSFET that's switching on and off. There's something else going on. So I think, Wesley, you need to explain a little bit. And there's a part of physics here that's not going to be very clear. And, you know, Wesley, you can try and straighten that out a little better so we get a better grasp of what you're doing.
Perfect. very fine. Now, whether or not Wesley wants to reveal all of this on the air, and maybe it involves some proprietary information that he's deriving, that's his choice. So I guess from what Eric is telling me, it's not just a pure supply of DC voltage feeding the MOSFET, which in turn is being used as a switching device going into the primary of your Tesla coil. I get the impression there's more going on there. And whether or not you want to reveal it over the air is your choice, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Dick, I'm not going to do it because nobody's going to believe it. I'm going to make a fun of myself, and people will just make a joke out of me. I saw it, you know. No. They're not going to believe. Simple like that. Back to you, Dick, N2XJN.
Well, all of the past scientists that ever did something out of the ordinary were told at some time in their career they're crazy and they should stop doing it. Edison was told he's wasting his time, he'll never find something that makes electricity into a light bulb, and so on. So you're tough enough, and you know not to be discouraged by derogatory statements. You're going to get them from time to time. And whether or not you want to tell us what you're doing is your choice. You're doing an interesting set of unusual experiments. And the classic Tesla coils are almost always air-wound. I have the impression that you're using ferrite, which in theory gives you the ability to use a much smaller number of turns and yet get a possibly a higher voltage. That's if the ferrite is just a pure mu material. But very few things in this world are pure. Depending on what brand of ferrite you're using and which one of the ferrites you're using, it has some natural stray capacitance effects and natural resonance effects of the toroid itself, which is further complicated by the windings that you're putting on top and the capacitance between those turns of those windings. So how much better or worse the ferrite wound Tesla coil will behave is interesting. By the way, I just saw, I'm trying to think now, was it Electronic Design News or Microwave Journal magazine? They have, I'm going to be sending you an email about a section you can go to where they have listed, let me drop, they have listed the names of all of the scientists that made a sea change, as they call it, or an earth-shattering change to our understanding of electronics over the last couple of hundred years. And Tesla, believe it or not, seems to be one of the first guys that really got a patent for radio ahead of Marconi. Everyone thinks Marconi invented radio. It's not quite that simple. Heinrich Hertz had a piece of the action. Maxwell had a piece of the action. Looks like Tesla did an awful lot with radio and so on. Got one of the very first radio patents. But when they describe all the things that he did, he was quite a guy. So whether or not a ferrite wound Tesla coil will give you more bang for the dollar or more high voltage for the size is an interesting set of experiments that you're running. And to quantify what you've got, to make its measurements on vector network analyzer, impedance bridge, and so on, put in sine waves, square waves, triangular waves, pulses, impulses.
Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I'll give you this much to think about. I mean, I wanted to leave it in Wesley's lap as to whether he wanted to really talk about what's there. But think of a relaxation oscillator without a physical capacitor, using inductance only, but the capacitive effects of the inductance. I mean, what he's doing is really cool. It's a little out of this world, and I like it.
Yeah, even though you don't put a capacitor across a coil, there always is stray capacitance between the turns. The way a Tesla coil is usually constructed, with the secondary winding, the bottom of it being grounded, and the top of it being a large metallic electrode. And the reason they do that is to try to decrease the amount of corona effects. When I'm operating my Wim Hof machine or my Van de Graaff generator, again, I'm using something like a large diameter electrode so that all of your high voltage doesn't get bled away by the so-called corona effect. You want to build up a high voltage so that when you finally get a spark, it's a significant one. Well, that great big metallic electrode that they almost always put at the top of a Tesla coil, that has a significant amount of capacitance even though you don't see the other plate of the capacitor, it has a significant amount of capacitance between it and the rest of the universe. I know that sounds crazy, but you'd be amazed how much capacitance there is.
That's what he uses.
Yeah, that capacitor is there. It's significant. The winding is feeding it. And so that's the dominant capacitor. You have some secondary capacitors between the windings and between the windings and the toroid core itself. So there's multiple resonators in there. And if you had the right kind of machinery that could sweep across all possible frequencies, as he's already done with his network analyzer, the fact that he found a 75 megahertz resonance as well as all the others doesn't surprise me. Now, which one of those resonators is going to be the dominant resonance after each impulse is applied to the primary and the secondary is allowed to ring? And it's the ringing effect of the secondary that gives you most of the effects that you visually see with a Tesla coil. And how do you maximize the particular dominant resonance of the secondary to get the maximum voltage effect out of the machine? That's some of the experiments that I think you're doing. I'm making some guesses here, Wesley. N2XJN, K2LIW in the Tech Man.
Hey, Dick, you can also think about pulsing the ring as it decays.
Oh, yes, and doing it in a co-phase manner if you get the timing just right. Is that what you're suggesting, Eric?
You can think of it like that.
In fact, that's sort of what's happening with a dipole antenna. You really are setting up a ringing voltage in the dipole, and if you set the length of the dipole and its electronic resonance just right, the energy coming out of your transmitter is really giving a co-phase impulse to the energy bouncing back and forth in the dipole on each cycle. So you've got lots of things to tweak and to tune up there. And whether or not you should put other capacitors between the windings, I doubt it, but that's something else to experiment with. And by the way, I'm wondering why you wound a clockwise and a counterclockwise coil. What was the intention there? And maybe what you intended to do is to have two separate field effect transistor feeding circuits where you sometimes fed the clockwise winding and sometimes fed the counterclockwise winding. Not quite sure what's going on there. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Eric would be able to give you better answers. He has excellent English skills to explain, Eric.
No, I'm not going to give too much away, but the two windings that are opposite, one being left hand, one being right hand, think of them as a little buck boost that occurs time-wise during the decay of the main transformer. There's a whole number of different things here that's going on. And there is a purpose to it. So stop thinking of it as a traditional Tesla coil. And if you can get it to work, it will be very, very interesting. You know, that the two coils that he's talking about, I suppose you could relate it to a buck boost kind of circuit. But, you know, each bridge is a cool idea, except that it would have to deal with very high voltages.
Yeah, the way we should reword this, though, Eric, is you said, if he can get it to work. What you and I really should be saying is, when he gets it to work. What do you think, Eric?
All right. Actually, when he gets it to work consistently. There's been some very positive results, but as with anything in science, you've got to make it repeatable.
I understand. And what Edison used to say is that real research is a little bit of experimentation and a whole lot of perspiration. You gotta have a lot of perseverance to go through all of the things that don't work. One of the universal statements that I used to say a lot is that all good ideas that are new do not work at first. You gotta work through all of the bugs, understand what's going on, what is Mother Nature telling you, and eventually make it work and make it work well. All brand new ideas, like the light bulb, poor old Mr. Edison had to go through thousands of materials before he finally found something that would convert electricity into light without using a spark. He decided to do it with some kind of a permanent structure. And I hear tell one of the very early Edison light bulbs is still in operation after almost 100 years. I'm going to move on for now, Wesley, and after we go through the questions we've got on tonight, we'll come back to your particular subject. I can tell it's going to be a set of experiments that's going to last a while. The third person who signed in tonight was John, KC2WGB. And what would you like to discuss tonight, John? K2LIWM and TechNet.
Good evening, Dick, and everybody on the TechNet. I have a question involving receiving an antenna, and let me let it drop. Okay, my question is, I'm interested in the perturbance of a magnetic field on a receiving antenna. Negate the capacitance and the inductive effect of the metal magnets near it. Just the magnetic field itself, a strong magnetic field on a receiving antenna, if you could just discuss a little bit about that. And that's my question. Thank you.
Yeah, depending on what frequency you're operating at, you've got one very big choice you can make. Because people used to think in E-fields, the AM broadcast antennas that operated from roughly half a megacycle to 1.5 megacycles, they used to be a voltage probe antenna. The whip that used to come out of the fender of the car was an extremely small fraction of a wavelength. Therefore, it became a kind of a voltage probe, so to speak, and was much more responsive to voltage than current. And in the old days, when you had one of those things, you just put your hand on it, and all radio reception essentially stopped. Your hand would kill 60 dB of the signal. If you weren't right alongside the broadcast station, nothing would happen. You know that the loop stick that you've got inside of a handheld transistorized AM radio is primarily a magnetic field pickup device, which works very well. And it's the easiest way of not putting a great big whip antenna onto the radio. And if you did do that, as you held onto the radio and let go of it, you would be tuning it and detuning it. By making a magnetic field sensing device, again, a very small fraction of a wavelength, it's doing a beautiful job of picking up that AM wave, and that transistorized pocket transistor radio works like a charm. Let me drop. So what I'm getting at as an example here is just at 1 megacycle, you've got at least 2 choices as to what kind of an antenna you make, an E-field sensing antenna or an H-field sensing antenna. And with proper engineering practice, you can make each one of them work very well. When it comes to a typical HF dipole, your 80-meter dipole or your 2-meter dipole, if you're using one of those, I think you're asking the question, what's really happening nearby? I could put voltage sensing instrumentation near the tips of the dipole, and I could measure some very high voltage. I could put magnetic field sensing instrumentation near the center of the dipole, and I would measure significant amount of magnetic field. And somebody might say, okay, what really does the radiation? Is it the magnetic field or the electric field? And the answer is yes, it's the combination of the two. And you could, if you want to, decide to shrink down the size of your dipole on 80 meters, for instance, by putting loading coils near the center, by putting ferrite materials on a loading coil near the center, by putting top hat capacitors near the tips, by zigzagging the wire. There's lots of ways in which you can mechanically shorten an 80-meter dipole and still get 95% of the performance if you've used the right materials. But there's a catch. As I've said so many times before, let me drop. The best bandwidth you're going to get is a full-length dipole made out of fat materials. If you had the ability to make an 80-meter dipole out of a birdcage of aluminum wires, and the birdcage was, 3 feet in diameter, and 6 wires or something like that going down these birdcages for the length of the whole 132 feet, you'd get a very broadband 80-meter dipole. As you use one single piece of wire of, 14-gauge, you'll get a slightly more narrowband dipole. As you start shrinking it by any of the effects I've mentioned, the dipole becomes more and more narrow. At the resonant frequency, you'll get full performance. But now you can't QSY very much without using a lot of tuning of your antenna tuner because the impedance changes very fast. That's a way of saying that the bandwidth of the dipole is much smaller. So give me a few more words as to what you intend to do with magnetic field, what you intend to do with magnetic materials, if that's what you're saying. And so a few more words as to what you would like to do with the experiment you're doing, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. I was looking at a